You can get it if you really want. Vietnam, The Harder They Come, and Many Rivers to Cross. Just a few of the reggae hits from Jamaican legend Jimmy Cliff, who passed away at the age of 81. Along with Bob Marley, few artists propelled his country's biggest export into the collective consciousness of the world as Jimmy Cliff. For this month's Philosophical Currents, Jimmy and music in general is very much on the mind of our in-house philosopher.
So as sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share now. What's mine? And then the harder they come, the harder they'll fall, one and all.
We are blessed again to be joined by Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, my good friend and philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota and host of the public radio program Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We're going to chat about the meaning of music, how it shapes our identity, and whether its role is evolving, especially in this digital age. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
I am happy to be here, but waking up to hear about Jimmy Cliff's death was not a nice way to start the day. They had just announced it about an hour before I looked at the internet, and he was, for me, a seminal figure in my sense of music, in my identity and how I expressed myself to the world. And his movie, The Harder They Come, which is a cornerstone of Jamaican cinema, is fused in my brain. And so I've been genuinely sad, as if I've lost someone who I have a real relationship with. And I suppose what we'll be talking about is the fact that I do.
Yeah. And when did it start for you, Jack? When did your relationship with him, and with Jimmy in particular, begin?
Well, I have a whole Why episode about ska and Jamaican music, and I offer a little bit of a biography, which I won't go into here, but the very short version is that I grew up in New York City in a very diverse place, the son of a jazz musician. Music was all around me, and I discovered this music called ska, which is the predecessor to reggae. And in the process of pulling that thread and finding a subculture, which we'll end up talking about, and a community, I discovered this album and this legendary movie, which, of course, I had on videotape, and I have the vinyl, and I still listen to the original vinyl. And the movie itself tells the story of a young musician from rural Jamaica who comes to the big city to become a pop star, and gets walked all over and gets involved in gangsters and ends up in a shootout with the police. And in many ways, it's very cliche, but in many ways, it tells the story that we all know so well of being young and wanting to impose yourself on the world and insisting on getting an audience. And so the music itself, to the modern ear, would be very old-fashioned. It's of a very specific time and a very specific place. And the soundtrack has him and a bunch of other early ska musicians who will later be identified as reggae. And it's just always been there. I remember seeing, and this is also something that many listeners will not be able to identify with, I remember seeing it in a revival theater when I was 16. Back in New York, there were a couple theaters that would show old movies, right? We videotapes didn't have everything. We only had the networks, right? All that sort of stuff. And everyone who went to see this movie was a fan. And everyone who went to this movie knew all of the music. In fact, in one of my great moments of parenthood, Adina, my daughter, was in New York City last year, and they had a screening of a restored print of The Harder They Come from film. And I think she had never seen a movie on film before. And I asked her, did you recognize any of the songs? And she laughed and she said, every single one of them by heart. And so that's how ever present this particular period of Jimmy Cliff has been. Although I think most people might know him by the reggae version of the song I Can See Clearly Now that ended the movie Cool Runnings about the Jamaican bobsled team.
So what happens to us philosophically when a song or a movement becomes part of who we are. I sense, Jack, that he is a part of who you are, like you said earlier.
This is a really interesting discussion, and there's been a lot of work lately about why teens in particular become so attached to music and why, as we get older, it's much harder to find new music and new connections, right? I'm sure you are like me, in which the vast majority of stuff you listen to is stuff you've been listening to for 20, 30 years.
I try to listen to indie pop every now and then, but I always find my way back to the yacht rock station. Now, what does that say about me?
Well, I'm not here. I'm not in a position to judge. But what the neuroscientists are telling us is that the synapses and neurons that are being fired during our teen years, from about 11 and 12 to probably early college, are being created simultaneously with our discovery of this music. And so it literally becomes hardwired into us in some way. And we start to identify this music with particular memories, particular emotions, particular relationships and connections. We can feel the angst that we might have felt as a teenager, or the isolation or the loneliness, which I'll come back to in a second. We can remember the time and place. The very first concert, this is again for our generation, the very first concert I went to, and I went by myself, was I was in sixth grade, and there was a 16 and underage show at a club from the band Musical Youth, which was the Jamaican band that sang that song Pass the Dutchie. And I remember every single moment of that experience, from going, from being there, from the people that I met. And so the first thing is that we are created, we are developed, we are evolving alongside the music that we choose. Then intertwine that with the way we want to project to the world, the clothes we wear, the words we use, the friends we want to identify ourselves with. That gets wrapped up into it too, but I'll wait until we get to that.
Well, tell me, Jack, historically, and are there moments in philosophy where music is treated not just as art, but as a tool for forming self? And I think my next question becomes, is this more of a psychological connection, philosophical, historically relevant, or explain it more for us?
So the biggest moment in the history of philosophy is for music is Schopenhauer. And Schopenhauer is a 19th century German philosopher, an idealist, meaning he thought that the core of the universe was abstract. It was ideas. And he centers music. And I always sort of jokingly describe his philosophy the same way. I always say, life is terrible. It's pain. It's suffering. We are lost. Nothing is ever going to happen to us that's good. But music is really nice. And what he's trying to do is come to grips with the thing that they just didn't have the ability to articulate back then, which was the way that our physical selves and the way that our imaginations are formed and intertwined with music. Now, music is ever present in culture, but music is also historically very disconnected from day-to-day life, because for most of human history, most people didn't own musical instruments. There was no records, there was no radio. You would hear traveling musicians play at festivals. You might hear choral music at church. Once they started to be able to mass produce the piano, people would have pianos in their homes, but you didn't have sheet music until around the late 19th and early 20th century. And that itself was a huge problem, because the recording industry thought that sheet music was going to mean that everyone was going to steal their music, and that everyone was going to violate their intellectual property. Every time there is a new technology for music, people freak out. So the intimate connection of artificially created noise that you and I take for granted is very, very new. Televisions, radios, hearing people on the news, the telephone, right? People had the sounds of the city. People had the sounds of cattle. People had lots of background. But to create, to design, to reproduce music is a very, very modern phenomenon. And so it's going to have a very different impact in the modern world than it would at any other time. And you see that particularly with teenagers in the 1950s. You see that with African-Americans in the United States in the 1920s and 30s, the birth of jazz, the birth of popular music coming out of New Orleans and Louis Armstrong. But it becomes, you see swing movement and things like that, but it becomes a dominant part of the culture in the 1950s when teenagers start having independence because of cars, independence because of extra money, and start asserting themselves as individuals who have their own world and their own way of talking to one another that isolates themselves from the adults around them, even if the adults are sitting right next to them.
Joining my conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, he's from the University of North Dakota, where he's a philosophy professor. Each month we have a chat, we call it Philosophical Currents, and today we're talking about Jimmy Cliff's passing, which for Jack has sparked a deeper reflection on music's meaning and in and on our lives. Jack, a friend of mine has a room in his house. On his tombstone, he wants it written, "And he had a good stereo." But he has a listening room. Nobody has a listening room anymore. His is awesome. He goes there and he listens to music. He has a wonderful collection, but we're all listening to it on the run. The AirPod comes in and out. What do you mean? Okay, back in and off we go. So the way young people have access to all music nearly instantly today, is that changing the emotional bond that music for you, and I think for me, maybe had in the past?
So the listening room phenomenon is really interesting because I've known a couple people who have had exactly that. And they will not only spend tens of thousands of dollars on high-end stereo equipment, they'll also be very, very precise about where the speakers go, about where the seat goes, about how high their head should be. And the goal there, and this is philosophically really interesting, the goal there is to not just have a wonderful experience, but to reproduce the sound in exact precise quality as it would be if you were in a symphony hall or in a jazz club or playing the lute in some Shakespearean context, right, in England. And that itself is a choice, because all art depends on our posture towards it. We have to ask whether we're interested in the product or the process. Is music the thing that we can play, the CD, the MP3, or is music the thing that you're playing and you're just recording? Is the job of a listener to understand completely and exactly what the composer or artist wanted you to understand, or is it to translate it to your own experience, right? We see, if you compare classical music, symphonic music, say, with jazz, symphonic music is intended to be reproduced exactly on the page with no improvisation, although the conductor will put their own stamp on it, and every musician sounds a little different. If you are a master oboe listener, you will be able to identify which oboist is playing in which symphony, when to other people it sounds exactly the same thing. B.B. King's guitar playing is like that. One note, you know exactly it's him, and no one at all can reproduce it. Jazz, on the other hand, is about improvisation. Jazz is about creating something new each time and the musicians playing with one another to create something that is expressive of their ideas and their experience at the moment. And this also necessitates having a conversation about who's more important, the audience or the musicians. This comes up. I do a wonderful episode of the show with my father, actually, who's a jazz musician. It's called The Logic of Jazz. And we talk about this. We talk about the fact that for many jazz musicians, they're playing for other musicians. Britney Spears, Taylor Swift, they are not playing for other musicians. They are playing for their audience. One is not necessarily better or worse than the other. But when you are playing for an audience that is seeking to identify with the artist, to be a Swiftie, for example, then a whole bunch of other stuff comes into play. And that, again, goes back to this idea of music being central to pop culture, because it also defines the clothes that we wear. It also defines the slang that we use. It also defines who our friends are. I was about 16 and I was in a small town, New York, which is of course different than a small town in North Dakota, but a small town, New York. And I'm wearing all super punk clothes, which is what I was into at the time. And I'm walking down the street and all of a sudden the town punks appeared out of nowhere and crossed the street to talk to me, because here was a stranger wearing the same clothes as him. And they needed to know who we are, who I was. And they knew that I was, and this is a word that comes up very much, particularly in the 80s and 90s when you talk about this sort of thing, I was a member of their tribe. And I was someone who they knew shared an overlapped core musical and social and fashion experiences, and that was our in. And that actually has changed a lot for a variety of reasons as the technology has changed, because you and I have the experience of looking through record stores, which is a very social act, and talking to the sellers and talking to other people, flipping through the vinyl. And we had artists that we were loyal to when we would listen to whole albums and not just songs, and a song that was, you know, a hit song off of an album felt sort of disconnected unless they were a one-hit wonder. Now, not only do young people have access to every single track ever recorded, but the youngest generation is discovering music in through TikTok, where if it doesn't attract their attention in the first 3 seconds, they swipe away.
Right, frickin' now. Yep.
Yeah. And it's a fundamentally different experience, and it's predominantly visual, right? You started the question by bringing up this distinction between listening rooms and the earphones or earbuds, and the big transition which happened in the early 80s with the invention of the Walkman was the shift from this idea that music was something you did and something you listened to, and it was an activity. You know, there would be background music at restaurants and stuff, but music was an activity in and of itself, or I should say listening to music was an activity in itself. And all of a sudden it shifts from being an activity to being the background music of other activities. And your sense of what you're listening to changes, your sense of how to listen to it change. If you're in a listening room, when the CDs, the digital remastered CDs of the Beatles collection was first released, I read a review that said it was amazing because you could hear Ringo's creaky pedal drum. The reproductive ability of the precise musical technology allows us to hear things. But if we're walking our dog, if we're hearing the tractor in the background, if we're doing other things, if we're reading while we're doing it, it changes the experience completely. So the folks who are vinyl collectors, on the one hand, it's just another kind of pretentious to show people that you have money and leisure. But on the other hand, it is a way of slowing things down and saying, look, we need to return to the time when listening to music was in and of itself an activity, and vinyl forces us to do that because you have to be there and you have to flip the record over 15 minutes, you know, every 15 minutes. And all of a sudden it's a return to this period, not to mention lots of people argue that vinyl is a warmer sign and a warmer sound and has a fuller spectrum and stuff I don't know that I have an opinion on. It's incredibly complicated.
What's one piece of music, Jack, besides what we've talked about, that's also shaped your sense of self or worldview, and why? And we have about 4 minutes or so left in our conversation today.
The final track of the movie version of the musical Hair, Let the Sun Shine In. The movie is an intense movie about hippies in the Vietnam War, and there's a death at the end. And the final song is this heart-wrenching, you know, clothes-tearing rendition of grief in the face of hope. And I cannot listen to it and do anything else. I have to listen to it, and it just holds my heart in its hand. And I can't listen to other versions. The original Broadway soundtrack doesn't do it for me. It for whatever reason, it is that movie version. It is that track.
Do you think that you're open, that we can remain open as we age to have those similar experiences, maybe reshape us, maybe reset us a little bit?
I'd like to think so. It is harder. And part of why it's harder is I have less opportunity to discover these things, and I've dedicated less time to it. But the flip side is, one of the things that I have managed to do is stay very connected to my daughter and her musical taste. And so she will send me things all of the time, and I have a playlist of music that she has suggested to me. Especially, there was a period when she was very into a band called 21 Pilots, and I have a bunch of 21 Pilots songs in this playlist, and I feel very intimately connected to them. I've seen them twice in concert, and it was incredible, but it is evocative of my relationship with my daughter. And I will never, ever listen to that music without having Adina next to me, even if she's not next to me. And that's, again, connected to the way that I experienced music as a teen. But now, in order to do it, I have to break through all of my adult stuff, and I have to hold on to the thing that is the most important thing to me in the entire world, which is my daughter. And then that music can do for me what listening to the Sex Pistols does for me, or the Clash, or the Toasters, right? Ska and hardcore punk are for me the core of my younger musical identity, as genres, as communities, as subcultures. And I'm never, ever, ever going to develop anything like that again. It's just not how it works.
I always feel, after today's conversation, I think I'm wrong, that sitting and listening to music is kind of a waste of time. I need to be doing something else. And perhaps now I've rethought that. My guest has been Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Our conversation began with Jimmy Cliff, who just passed away today, but it really became about us, about how music creates meaning in our lives and why those early songs stay with us. You can hear more from Jack on his monthly philosophy program available here at Prairie Public. Jack, thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you to you. And I will just add, attending to art is never a waste of time. It is one of the most human things that we can do. And happy Thanksgiving to you and all of our listeners who celebrate it.
Thank you.